Journey Church is a community and movement, a fellowship of discovery. We desire to love well and serve often, as together we explore the adventurous love story of Jesus.
How many of you got into the World Cup this summer? Did anybody get in? Okay, cool. Eight of you and me enjoyed the World Cup. It was a great deal. I love soccer. I grew up playing soccer. I coached soccer. I'm excited about the Rekt League and already feel like maybe we should just go ahead and put some crutches, like maybe up front or make them available, because I'm sure it's only a matter of time before, at our age, something will happen. But it'll be fun. We'll get out there and kick the ball around. It'll be a good time. Maybe you didn't watch the soccer, but did you at least observe some of the press around the World Cup? Did you see any of the cool graphics about Brazil? And, you know, if you did, if you watched any of it at all, then you saw shots of Brazil, and in particular Rio de Janeiro. And there's this iconic shot that when they do a camera pan, or if they're doing one of those the kind of cool graphic things, eventually, if you see a shot of Rio, two things usually show up every time. One is Sugarloaf Mountain, which is this mountain peak that rises up out of the water. And then secondly, it's the Christ statue, Corcovado. I love Brazil. As a matter of fact, when it came time to plant Journey, Angie and I were like, God, should we plant a church in Brazil? We spent most of the decade of the 90s, a lot of it in Brazil, back and forth, multiple times a year, doing a lot of work with orphan care. Just, eu amo Brasil. I love Brazil. And so to see the World Cup there was, you know, to watch that was amazing. I can imagine being there. I spent some time in Rio. And one of the times I was there, one of the guys said, hey, do you want to get a helicopter and fly around the Christ statue? To which I was like, sure, yeah. So we did, and, you know, took the chopper around the Christ statue. And it was amazing. So I've seen, like, that iconic, like, I've seen it from helicopter. Gary and I were there not too many years ago, and we made the trek up the mountain, so we did it by foot. So I've stood at the base. I've seen it from afar. I've been at the beach in Copacabana looking, you know, taxi rides, wondering if I was going to die, looking out the window. So I've seen it, like, from all these vantage points, and it just really is iconic. And you think, oh, all this stuff you hear about Rio, because, if you heard anything in the news, you hear a lot about crime, you hear a lot about immorality, and you hear a lot about culture and all this stuff about Rio. And yet, here's the city where their icon is a statue of Jesus with his hands outstretched, bidding you come. I give you that as a backdrop because I just, like, if you can kind of capture that feeling for that city, a port city, and its iconic image in the city and its struggles below, I want to talk to you about another city, maybe make some parallels, or at least a generalization. Back up the timeline all the way to about AD 54, and imagine that you are an 18-year-old boy. If you're a lady, well, maybe you shouldn't imagine that. Just pretend you could be a lady, and it's okay. You're 18. You're the child of a merchant. You're on a sailing vessel, and you're heading toward this city. And it's a storied city. It's a city in the land of Greece. And your dad's fairly wealthy, and so you've seen some things. But your home's not, you know, you just kind of live in a nice little home, you know, somewhere over there, and off the Mediterranean somewhere, or whatever. But you're on this trip, and you've heard stories. But here you go, and somebody knocks on the cabin door, and you come running out of the cabin, and you stand out on the deck of the ship, and as the ship is coming into port, and you see the city of love. It's not Vegas. But it looks some ways a little. It has Vegas-esque elements. It's crazy. The city is rowdy. It's nuts. Some of the sailors are nearby, and they're doing the rigging and whatever, and one of them, like, jabs you, and let's go back to the boy thing for a moment, and jabs you, and he's, hey. You see that? And you look, and at the highest point, top of a mountain, there's not a Christ statue. There's a temple there, though. It's a focus of worship. Similar to the city I told you about last week, city of Ephesus, there's a temple on this highest place. And he elbows you and he goes, boy, that's where you want to go. And you're like, what? I want to go there? Yeah, you want some enlightenment? You want to learn a little bit about the world? If you want to find some love, That's the place. The Temple of Aphrodite. And so the ship docks and you get off and off you go into the city. And just the sights and sounds are unbelievable. And people are running up to you with little trinkets. And they've got this like little miniature temple right here. And they're like, hey, I sell you, I give you a good deal. And, you know, they want to sell you the thing. And you're buying, oh, cool, I'm going to have a little temple trick. Here's a statue of Aphrodite. Oh, that'll be good too. You need to have that. And everything is kind of the focal point of the city. But you've got to visit the temple. Well, what's at the temple? Enlightenment is at the temple. Because this is Greece, and what you want more than anything is enlightenment. It's not just about pleasure, it's about enlightenment. But the sexual experience you will have in that temple will be beyond anything you could possibly ever imagine. There are priestesses there waiting for you to enlighten you in a world of sexual experience that you've never imagined. They're really temple prostitutes, but they went by priestess. And the whole city's culture was built around this. And it was a rocking city. I mean, people came from everywhere. This is the place to be, the city of Corinth. And like Ephesus, there was money pouring into it as a place of commerce. It was a place of culture. It was a place of academia. It was the love city. When I say Aphrodite, it's where we get the term aphrodisiac. Aphrodite was the goddess of love. She was the path to finding not just true love, but knowledge and truth. Sexuality was just the medium of finding this wonderful enlightenment. Of course, what do we know, not just historically, but what do we know in our experience with cultures and cities that value? You know, the thing about Vegas is at least Vegas is like, oh, it's sin. You know, you appreciate it. Vegas isn't calling it love. Vegas doesn't say we're the love city. They're like, that's sin city. You know, we won't tell anybody what happened here. Why? Because you'd feel shame. Okay, well, thanks for being honest. At least there's some good marketing that way. This place, it was like, no, this is about enlightenment and love. So there was this false piece about it. Of course, what do we know? It was rampant lust. Not love, and produced a soul-destroying, narcissistic culture. And what became challenging for a young church that was being birthed in the middle of this culture is that they hadn't had many reference points for real love. Paul, who I told you about, who's this early missionary church planter, he's the guy who planted the church in Ephesus, he also plants this church in Corinth, and then he goes and he plants other churches, and he stays in touch with them through email. And so as he's traveling, he's kind of in correspondence, and somebody shoots an email off to Paul, and they're like, Paul, look, things are not good in the church right now. Like, we need some direction, we need some help. And so Paul starts to hear the stories, and he's like, okay, I've got to guide these young Corinthian believers. Because what happened was he started a church here, and people, he taught about this person, Jesus. And Jesus, for some people, maybe they'd heard a little bit about him, what happened over there in Rome and the Roman Empire and how they were involved and what happened over there in Jerusalem. And so they'd heard maybe little rumblings about Jesus. But he came and he said, hey, this Jesus person actually is God. And he didn't just die, but he came back to life. He resurrected. That was a really big moment. Everybody in those days believed in life after death. That wasn't hard to comprehend. But the fact that someone would come to life on earth, now that was a big deal. And became a point of a lot of conversation. Paul actually has to deal with it in one of these emails. There's two emails, First Corinthians and Second Corinthians. And he has to deal with it in this correspondence. Talk about this thing called the resurrection. But the church was birthed because there were those who were there who were going, my soul is dying. That everything people promised about love was not love, it was lust. I feel death inside. There must be another way. And Paul comes and introduces them to Jesus, and the light of life begins to take root in them, and they begin to change. However, they don't just flush out all their cultural idiosyncrasies in one night. It doesn't just immediately go away. And we discover this about us. We are all truly on a journey. Spiritual maturity takes time. We sign up as an apprentice of Jesus, and we learn the Jesus way. This is called discipleship, growing in our faith. These Corinthian believers, their struggles were unique to their culture. So if you read the letters, Paul's like, yeah, sleeping with your mother-in-law on the altar of the church. Like, let's start there. You can't do that. Like, it's not good. And he starts there, and he really starts to unpack for them. Like, guys, you've pledged your lives to Jesus. Your life has to look differently. There are elements of your culture that you're going to have to shed. You're going to have to get rid of. You're going to have to understand real love. So doesn't it make sense that if there was a chapter that the church for hundreds of years has said, I wonder when the Bible talks about love, is there like one chapter in particular I should go to? And the church for years has said, yeah, there's a chapter, and we've even deemed it through the years. We call it the love chapter. Doesn't it make sense that the love chapter is written by a guy named Paul who's trying to help a young church in a city where they had a false understanding of love? It's quite beautiful, actually. And so what Paul does is he goes, look, I'm going to have to explain love to you. I'm going to give you like a little rundown. And when you read it at first, it seems kind of elementary. But Paul says, you know what, let me give this to you. I want to help you understand truth. And so let's read from 1 Corinthians chapter 13. And if you've been to a wedding, maybe you've heard this. Maybe it's on your grandmother's wall at home. It's a familiar passage for those who've been involved in the church. And yet, as you listen to it as if you were a young Corinthian believer who grew up, and maybe even, again, depending on when you found Jesus, you'd visited the temple multiple times, you'd slept with multiple prostitutes, the debauchery that was around was all the time, the craziness going on 24/7. Maybe you were a priestess. One of the reasons Paul has to talk to the women about covering their heads is because the priestesses were bald. So he was saying, you know what, I think you should cover your head just so people don't think you're on the job. Because, oh, you're here, like you're soliciting. No, I found Jesus. Okay, it'd be less confusing if you put something on your head. Oh, okay. Of course, then in like 1945, women suddenly have to wear hats to church. You know, anyway, that's typical how we interpret scripture. But so 1 Corinthians 13. If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, Paul's talking about himself. If I'm the order of all orders, like if I'm slick tongue, like, I'm an inspiring communicator, and I don't have any love. I'm a resounding gong or clanging cymbal. Have any of you ever made the mistake at Christmas of buying your child a toy that makes a repeating noise? Honey, can you put the toy down? Honey, just go. Can you go in the room? Put the toy away! This is the same as someone who's a gifted speaker without love. You're just making noise. And it's annoying, actually. Could you be quiet? Have you ever heard a speaker who's not loving? If I have the gift of prophecy and I can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, he's tapping into the whole knowledge Greek thing right there. If I have the faith that can move mountains, but I have not love, I'm nothing. You're no big deal. If I give all I possess to the poor, because the young Corinthian church, the churches early on got it, like, oh, it's not optional. We're supposed to serve those who are under-resourced. If I give all I possess to the poor and I surrender my body to the flames, this is the time of Nero. Christians were being murdered. They're being dressed up like animals and then eaten by animals. If I surrender my body to the stake, to flames, but I have not love, I gain nothing. Love is patient. This is what love is. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. By the way, again, imagine you're a Corinthian believer and people are like, hey, we got an email from Paul. Woo! All right, everybody gather around. Okay, who's going to read? I'll read, okay. Love is patient. Whoa. Wow. Honey, no, I'm not. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. I mean, they would have been like, ooh. They've been feeling the weight of this. It was such a contrast to what so many of them were like. It is not rude. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Love never fails. Now, I just kind of inserted, because it's a long email, but when he drops into this section in love, it would have been mind-blowing. And again, I want to make sure you have a picture of the folks who are here. Corinth is like all the big fish in the little ponds all made their way to Corinth. It'd be like L.A. or New York or Nashville. Like, you're a big deal. You and your guitar in your town were a big deal. And you get to Nashville and you're like, the accountants have guitars in their rooms. I just went to the doctor. He had his guitar on the deal. It doesn't matter what you do in this town. At some point, you had a guitar. If I had everybody stand up who had a guitar. If you own a guitar, that's just fun. I have been gone for a while. If you own a guitar or have ever owned a guitar, would you please stand? This is just for fun. If you know someone who owns a guitar, would you please stand? I love this city. All right, you can sit down. See what I mean? This is great. That just made my day right there. So awesome. So this town, right? This is Corinth. Everybody came to make a name. Like, they came to do it. They came to be the thing, whether it was music, whatever. Maybe it was just being a successful businessman, whatever the thing was. But they came. Corinth attracted those kinds of people. So these folks had a flair for the dramatic. I mean, they naturally did. So when Paul opens up the conversation about love, he starts by creating, like, hey, let's talk about some of these things that you're doing, and I need to give you a contrast because they're empty without love. And he goes after what we call sometimes in the church the sign gifts. I don't have a whole lot of time to drop down here. I did a podcast on this a while ago, so if you go, hey, what's the deal with sign gifts? Because some churches like believe that the sign gifts are still for today, and some believe that they're not, and some believe that they're abused, and some believe that they're beautiful. I happen to believe in our church's place is that they are still applicable for today, but as Paul has said, in order to use gifts, the nature of a gift from God is that it doesn't draw attention to yourself, but draws attention to the Spirit of God. It's always a good way to evaluate a gift. If you're always like, oh, I'm the man, like it's always drawing attention to you, then you're missing something. That's the point Paul is making here when he drops down into these things. So the first one he talks about is speaking in tongues, or kind of a heavenly prayer language, or if you're just a great speaker in general. But if you have the gift of tongues, you have the gift of speaking, he's saying without love, it doesn't mean anything. If you're a prophet and you have insight, he goes, it doesn't mean anything without love. Now, this is very important, because you ever met this personality who goes, hey, I'm just a prophet. They walk in and they light you up about something. It wasn't invited. They just felt like it was very important that they tell you that all the things wrong in your life. Hey, I'm called by God. I'm a prophet. Sorry, just got to take it. You go, that wasn't really kind or loving. Sorry, that's not me. I don't have the gift of mercy. A prophet. There it is. Paul says, look, it doesn't matter if you're a prophet. If it's not, if your motive was not for the sake of the kingdom, was not loving, then you're just making a lot of noise. Your words are empty. Your words are hollow. It is not coming from a heart full of love. When he talks about faith, generosity, and martyrdom, he's saying, you know, maybe you have the gift of faith. You know, you can challenge what other people think is safe. And maybe you have the gift of generosity, and you love to give things away. Maybe you're great at physical sacrifice, and you're so willing to sacrifice. He said, look, absent love, they're all pseudo-versions. I can't remember. Some philanthropist said, look, if you really want to test whether or not someone's generous, just see how often they give anonymously. If they got to have their name on everything, then they're not generous. They're working the angle. In the church, by the way, this idea of sacrifice, you know, sometimes some of us come across like, you know, hey, oh man, I'm so sacrificial. It's not really sacrifice. It's Richard Rohr calls it the myth of heroic sacrifice. That you go, you know, hey, hey, I have a little of this in me. Like, I'm willing to take one for the team. It doesn't matter to me. I defer my preference, all those things. But I'll tell you what can happen there. It really can be, again, a therapeutic term here is codependency, but it really is this, like, I'm actually managing you, and I'm going to do, quote, less so that I can build my moral stance and actually be quite judgmental of you inside. So if you meet somebody who's a martyr, like, all the time, they're always the martyr. Oh, no, it's okay. Let them trample over me. If you meet that person, the truth is probably deep down, they're very resentful. It's a good way to actually test. Is this, like, are you really taking one for the team? Are you really sacrificing? Or is this actually, you're devaluing yourself, or you're actually managing, in your mind, your moral standing amongst the crowd or the family? Because, see, most of us in our families, we have the martyr. The uncle, the mom, the dad, you have somebody who's always taken one for the team. And even when you write them birthday cards, you're like, oh, you're so sacrificial. No, they're not sacrificial. It's a game. I could talk about that for a long time. We won't. Paul's teaching this very gifted body of believers that the way they are living is destroying the reputation of Christ. It's dismantling their ability to care for one another and disturbing their souls. Why? Because they don't have love. Today, you'll have a chance to meet some of our new partners here, and at the end, I always give them a charge, and we talk about what it means to be in a loving community. It's so easy to drift from love. And for these young believers, again, as I said in the beginning, they just don't have much of a reference point. Everything is so new for them. Love has not yet been understood. The lust of their culture took on a different look, but it remained lust all the same. See, what they did was they're like, okay, I'm not going up to the temple anymore and sleeping with the prostitutes, and I'm not going doing the party scene, and I'm not cheating people out in the marketplace. But what they did was they brought some of that element into the church, and some of that behavior is happening just in different ways. So it didn't look like the blatant kind of immoral thing, but there was an absence of kindness. There was an absence of patience. And then there were these delighting still in evil. Paul's calling these things out. Here's a great way to see this. Let's flip. I did this one time for you guys when we talked about love and lust. And if you flip this passage completely around, you see what Paul is calling out in them. Listen to the passage like this. Lust wants immediate gratification. I'm uncomfortable. I want to be comfortable. Now, lust. You go, well, I thought lust was like just a sexual thing. No. Lust is the pseudo version of love. Lust is unkind. Lust is jealous. Lust is abrupt. Lust is always me first. Lust gets angry when it doesn't get what it wants. Lust plays the victim card. Lust finds its pleasure in what ends in shame. If you take Paul's statements about love and flip them, this is what he's describing. And lust emanates from our addictions. You might go, well, you know, I don't have any addictions. Okay. How about I use a different word? Do you have a weakness? Is it a prevalent weakness? Is there a place that you go, man, if there's a place Satan tends to get me, it's here. Okay. So there's a pattern with that weakness. Is there an idol that you tend to drift to? I've told you guys before, I tend to group idols into three categories: comfort, power, and approval. Are any of those three things kind of a favorite idol? Are you obsessed with your comfort? Like, you want to be comfortable. And when you're not comfortable, you're angry. That means you have an addiction to feeling comfortable. That's an idol that you go to. It's an addictive behavior. It's a habitually ongoing, active action on your part. Is it power? You like to be in control. And when you're not in control, you're upset. It could be control over your schedule. It could be control over people's behaviors. It could be control over the United States government. Good luck. It could be lots of different things. You don't feel like you're in control, and you're again, you there's something coming out of you. Maybe you're resentful, or it's approval. It's the God that you go to is this is the one I tend to go to fastest. Is this the approval thing? Is do people like me? Martyr, if you remember I talked about the martyr thing, a lot of times that's approval. My ongoing functioning pattern in my life is this way because of my idolatry of approval. We have addictions. We have a habitual way of seeing the world, of framing reality. Where did this come from? DNA, it came from culture, it came from family of origin, it came from books and mentors and churches. So let me ask you this question. Is it probable, even plausible, that something in your operating system that's aggregated from all these things, your culture, your town, your family, your DNA, your wiring, your personality, all those things that kind of makes you, this operating system whereby you function and see the world, is it possible, even plausible, but that something in that operating system is not perfect? That there's something that might be faulty? That maybe there's something you are not aware of because you frame reality through a certain lens? And if you met a guy who lives in New Delhi, India, who loves Jesus, and the two of you sat, he might see the world slightly through a different lens based on his story. And is it possible that he sees something you don't, and you see something he doesn't? What I'm getting to is, don't we all live with a certain ongoing lack of awareness? I talked with a gentleman between the gatherings, and he's telling me about a struggle in a situation in his marriage. And he was saying, man, like, there's this aspect of love I think I do well, but this aspect of love, I don't know if I'm doing it right. And I said, let me let you off the hook. Like, you've actually failed your wife across the board thousands of times. He was like, what? I'm like, no, like, if you try to grade yourself, I think it's healthy to go, hey, is this fruit producing in my life? That's really healthy. But if you go, no, I got this one on lockdown, but this one I don't have figured out, think about what you were not aware of. Think about 10 years from now when you go, oh, I had no idea I used to do that. Think about what we're not aware of right now. There's something in your life not working. And you might not know for 20 years. You might not have the enlightenment. You may not answer the quest for knowledge. You might just be jacked up and that's the deal for a while. Some of you are like, I have a lot of anxiety right now. Let me tell you what Jesus says about that. You don't have to. He even goes on to say, don't even worry about tomorrow. Let tomorrow take care of itself. Because in your lack of awareness, in your addictive state, in your broken flesh, I love you. Just like that. Yeah, but I need to get this better. I love you while it's not working. I love you in what you don't see. Flush that Platonic Greek thought out of your system that you got to have it figured out before you can move to the next plane. Let it go. God's saying, I love you right there in that spot. My grace is big enough, long enough, deep enough. Can you trust me and understand that all is not perfect in your world? There are things hidden in our subconscious. There are neural pathways that facilitate and prompt behaviors in microseconds that we don't even know about. And Jesus says, here's the thing. I have created a way for you to not live in anxiety and for you to be successful at living life on this earth and for you to give love away. And it's called the kingdom. It's a completely different dimension of existing. And it's around you and alongside you. And if you followed me, even in you. And it's always a matter of tuning in. We spent, in the spring, we talked a lot about the kingdom and about prayer. We went through, we in the church called the Lord's Prayer, and how the Lord's Prayer helps us tune into the ways of the kingdom. But I'm going to tell you that there's another way to have access to the kingdom, that literally, those same microseconds where your faulty fleshly system is making a decision, within those same microseconds, you can be right back in the kingdom way. And the avenue, the action, is love. Through simple acts of love, you can stay connected and aligned in his kingdom way. And this is an important thing to understand about love, because sometimes, even as I'm reading, like, love is patient, love is kind, some of you, maybe immediately, you even went, yeah, I gotta, that's good. I gotta be more patient. That's good. And I gotta be more patient because, like, right now, my things with my wife aren't good, and I gotta be kind. And sometimes my tone with my kids, and I don't want my kids to grow up jacked up like me. And okay, this is good. It's good. I'm glad I came today. And the frame immediately is, I should do this because it will make my life better. And from a certain perspective, depending on whether or not that's flesh or spirit, part of that motivation might be like completely self-absorbed. Oh yeah, I should be loving because I want my life to work better. And life is about me. And the truth is, I should love more, I'll be more comfortable. I should love more, people will like me. If I love just the right way, I'll have more control. You see, like, how sick it can get quickly? But in the spirit, that love, the compulsion toward love, if you go, yeah, but I did have that emotion. Like, I do want to be more patient, and I want to be kind, and I want to stop some of that other stuff. That stewardship from the spirit, that stewardship going, yes, of course, I want to represent Jesus the right way, and I do want my life to be healthy and right and whole and good. But there's such a fine line there. And so I think this part, not attached to what I'm about to tell you, will never sustain on its own. It will always drift to lust. The part that says, I want to be patient and kind because I want my relationships to work better out of stewardship, will lose its spirit and revert right back to self-absorption without what I'm about to tell you. And if you lock onto this, it could be life-changing because we tend to live so self-absorbed. We swing back and forth between those two things so fast. Stewardship of you has to be connected to a greater whole because the world is not about you. Since the world is about giving glory to God, and we're on the planet to transfer that glory and to share this love story, then you are connected to other people. Community of believers, but also those who carry the image of God. Actually, even beyond that, you're connected to creation. We're going to talk about this a little bit next week. Here's the connection. Why should you be motivated to love? We love to contribute to the ongoing restoration of the kingdom. We've actually been invited to be a co-creator and a co-contributor. You're part of a mission to restore the planet. All of life on the planet that's been broken since Eden, we're on our way back to Eden. God is going to restore us to Eden. We're heading toward wholeness. We can taste a form of heaven now, but there is a not yet element of it, and we're supposed to be contributors to the restoring of God's goodness. And when we can maintain that bigger perspective, the lens is out. Yes, I want to be better for me because I want my relationships to be better and I want to be loving, but I want love to be in my life because I want to represent Jesus well to the world. I'm a co-contributor. I'm sharing in this. This is why, when we switch to lust, because you might go, well, how do I know if I'm doing that? Like, how do I know if my motive is true? Here's a pretty good picture. Here's how you know you're off center, and the love is dissolved into self-absorption and lust. Something inside is disrupted. You've run from home. You feel lost in the dark, like that feeling when you can't find your parents. And the night is cold with scary noises. And the warmth of the kingdom that you once knew is missing. If you know what I'm talking about, then you know lust. You know the absence of love. And what often happens, that an entire Old Testament is devoted to explaining our default, is we go, oh, I hate this feeling. I'm so alone. I'm so cold. I don't know if I can ever get back. We say, I got to pull myself up by my bootstraps. I can get there. I can get there. I can fight my way back. Okay, I can do this. And we've got lots of human philosophy that feeds this thing a little bit. Okay, all right, I've got enough willpower. The human spirit's got enough inside. I can dig deep. I can go for it. And we clamor to find our way back, believing that if we can get it right with just enough knowledge, we may not go to prostitutes for enlightenment, but we go to a lot of other places prostituting ourselves for enlightenment. If I can have just enough knowledge, if I can just get back there, then I can find the kingdom again. And the quest for knowledge and rightness, our desire to be right, leaves us scarred by the low limbs and the abundance of thorns. And the great irony is that the kingdom hasn't gone anywhere. Teleportation to the kingdom is just one act of love away. Knowledge, my friends, is not the end game. Love is. 1 Corinthians chapter 8, just a few chapters earlier. But while knowledge makes us feel important, it is love that strengthens the church. I went for a walk last night while I was studying. Just went for a walk in the neighborhood. And I looked up, and something was rushing toward me. And across this field, this deer was just bounding, flying by. And I was like, hello. And he ran, just like 15 yards in front of me. And the hooves got to the street and was like kind of scrambling. And I had this kind of crazy moment, oh, it's a deer. Yeah, just come here, and I could pet him. And then this other thing, right there, that's a great shot. It was a strange kind of emotion and all at the same time. I wanted to pet him and shoot him. And I know some of you are like, that's sick, but I'm to eat, of course, and jerky. And it was pretty scrambling, and it was more of the, isn't that nice, it's a deer thing. And he just grabs his hooves, and I was like, oh, he's going to fall. No, I got to get it. Off he goes. It's like, oh, look at you. When I have moments like that, I'm always like, oh, God, should I be aware of something? That was kind of an interesting interaction with your creation. And you know what? Immediately brought the verse to mind. The psalmist writes, as the deer pants after the water brook, so my soul pants after you. And it's a passage I'm familiar with. It came to mind. And I thought for a moment, wait a minute. When a deer is fully on the run and panting, and I learned this while I was out hunting with my friends. They were explaining to me when a deer is in heat, when a doe's in heat and it's making itself available, bucks, even seasoned bucks, like old bucks that know better, that know where the stands are and how to avoid the hunters, for those 24 hours, they throw caution to the wind. It doesn't matter. They are on the prowl. They throw caution to the wind. As a matter of fact, sometimes they're so intense after what they want that they forget what they need, driven by their lust. I was like, oh, that might be a parallel. And I thought about that passage for a moment, and I thought, sometimes I think about that passage like, oh, that's really good. I want to pant after God. But then I thought, wait, maybe the panting is like post, maybe I shouldn't be pant, actually, I don't, I want to already be there. When I look at that deer, the tongue hanging out and all swollen, he's past the point of need. And I found Charles Spurgeon, old English preacher in 1868, said this: if the psalmist had maintained unbroken communion with his God, he would not have been so much panting after him as just simply enjoying him. It is deeply to be deplored that we who sometimes bask in the sunshine of God's countenance cannot live so as always to enjoy it. that sometimes the only time we come to the water is when our tongue is swollen, hanging out of our mouth, panting because lust didn't do it for us. And we're about to die. We don't survive long without water. Our soul dies without God. Lust always wants more. And what it wants more of is never enough. So lust leaves us endlessly dissatisfied, even exasperated. Love, on the other hand, is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It is not rude. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Forgiveness frees you and the other person, the operative word being free. Love does not delight in evil. A friend of mine posted a thing on Justin Bieber, and he said, you know what, I'm recalculating. You know, we make fun of him and all this stuff. He's just a kid. And there's this sick part of us in America that actually we like the feeling of somebody with wealth and fame and whatever. We like watching them fall. And there are entire TV shows and tabloids dedicated to that sick part of us that actually finds enjoyment, delighting in the destruction of a human soul. It was interesting. He said, I'm rooting for Bieber. I'm pulling for him. Kid with a soul lost in a Corinth-like environment, how would you fare? There's a thing about the curse, the struggle that we have with the flesh. I actually think it's a gift. This ever-present angst that something's not right, that we want more. When humanity sinned and God disciplined them with the curse, I think the discipline was an act of love to remind us it's never going to be too good for too long because it's imperfect. You will be dissatisfied because you're supposed to be. It's an ever-present reminder that there is more. And that you're on the planet to contribute with me in that restoration of wholeness. And one day, whatever heaven looks like, you will govern alongside me. And together, we will be displaying ongoing glory to the world, but from a place of perfection, not emptiness. Would you bow your heads, close your eyes with me? Just some space for meditation, reflection. If you're journaling, feel free to keep journaling. Maybe you've already begun a conversation with God. Feel free to continue. Just tune me out and talk to Him. Maybe you're here this morning and you go, listening to the scripture describe love is exhilarating because this has been something I've longed for, and I feel renewed and excited and enthusiastic about displaying this love, and my heart is full of gratitude, and I want to give it away. I can't wait to display patience and kindness, to lean into a love that never fails. Maybe that's not you. Maybe you're here this morning and you say, you know what, honestly, lust is really characteristic of my life. Paul could have written that to me. I would have fit well in that young church. And the truth is, Jamie, I don't have a lot of reference points. Life's been a lot of struggle. Do you hear the hope today? That God meets you where you are, any place on that journey. He seeks you out just like he did these young Corinthians. That maybe this message was for a church in AD 54, but in God's sovereignty, he allowed them to struggle through it so that it could be recorded and offered to you today. Because he said on August 3rd, 2014, one of my children will desperately need to know that I love them and I can empower them with just a childlike willingness. And that the kingdom is a heartbeat of love away. Father, I pray for all of us, your bride, the church. I confess that collectively as the church, sometimes we do a really lousy job of representing you. And there's some gross stuff we display. But would you hear from this church a desire, Father, to love well? To keep learning about love. But more than that, more than a preoccupation with knowledge, that we would simply act in a loving way. We'd refrain from anger and we would choose kindness. We would serve someone in need. That we would contribute to the restoration of the kingdom. And that we would be willing to explore what that means for us in our uniqueness, in our design, in our struggles and failures and successes and triumphs. Our DNA, it's just us. And it has beauty. So Lord, would you just allow us to be known deeply by you today? Whisper the hope that this is not an inattainable quest, but just a simple, heartfelt behavior that gets us realigned. We surrender our lives to you. We die to the lust that creeps up. We offer ourselves as a living sacrifice, whole and holy unto you. If you're interacting with God right now and you want to just stay in that place, please do. Just listen and pray. If you're a guest with us, I just want to let you know and invite you that our band is going to lead in a little bit and we invite you to sing along with us, but there are stations around the room, places to pray. There are places to give. Our offering boxes are stationed in the back and in the front. There are also places to take of the elements to remember the sacrifice of Jesus on the cross. There's no rush here. It's you enjoying your Heavenly Father. So just be in His presence today.